Warmanali back with To the Point. In rural Mexico, 5 million of the poorest families are getting cash grants from the government, but only if their kids stay in school, if parents and children get regular medical checkups, and if the mothers attend workshops to learn what it takes to stay healthy. The program is called Oportunidades, Opportunities, and it's designed to break what's called the culture of poverty, handed down through generations. In last Sunday's New York Times Magazine, Tina Rosenberg reported on what's called Mexico's first effective anti-poverty program. Tina Rosenberg, welcome to our program.
Pleasure to be here, Warren.
You went to Mexico, spent a lot of time there. Tell us what this looks like on the ground.
Well, I went to a couple of villages that have been in the program the longest, so they really have about 10 years of experience with it. And from what they told me, the places they live are very different than they were before the program started. They are getting cash grants that help them live better, and that makes a very concrete difference in people's lives. They can buy things and do things that they couldn't do before. But I'd say just as important in the places I saw is the change in their mentality. And things are really different. The women have a lot more influence and power. They're much more organized. They get together with each other. They can leave their houses more. Many of these women beforehand very rarely went out of their houses, and their husbands laid down a law to keep them there. And the kids, instead of dropping out of school very early to work in the fields and help their families do that, now they can make more money for their family almost by staying in school. So high school rates, for example, are up, I think, 85% in rural areas over what they were before. And the children really now have, a better chance at a future than they used to.
A better chance at a future, a change in mentality. Now you're getting at the issues of what's called the culture of poverty.
Yes. I don't know that the purpose of the program was that. I think it was really designed as what's a way we can help the poor. And you, I guess you're going to be talking to Santiago Levy, who designed it.
We are.
And what he told me was that they had this very, very ineffective, badly targeted, corrupt system of food subsidies where you could buy your tortillas and bread and milk, but you'd pay less. And that was the anti-poverty program. It was a very bad anti-poverty program, in part because it didn't really help the poor. For example, poor Mexicans don't eat bread. They eat just tortillas. So it didn't get to where it needed to go. And so what he did was take the opportunity of the big Mexican peso crash in the mid-90s to put in a different system, and one that I think has been very successful in Mexico and is now attracting a lot of attention around the world.
Well, again, Tina Rosenberg is with the New York Times Magazine. We'll come back to you, talk further about what's called the culture of poverty. But let's first go to Santiago Levy. Again, he's the vice president for sectors and knowledge at the Inter-American Development Bank. As an official in the Ministry of Finance and Public Credit of Mexico, he was the main architect of the Oportunidades program, the Opportunities program. And Santiago Levy, thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. Good afternoon. And just before I start, let me thank Tina Rosenberg for her very nice article on Sunday. Congratulate her because she really caught the idea. And thank you, Tina, for some very nice quotes.
Thanks.
Glad you could make friends again on our program. Good to get you back together. One of the very interesting aspects of this, it seems to me, has to do with what the word that Tina Rosenberg used earlier, and that's corruption. How do you manage to get cash grants directly to poor people in rural areas and avoid corruption?
An important component of the program is what we call co-responsibility. It's not hand-downs or hand-me-downs. It really is money that, quote, people earn by their good behavior, as Tina was explaining, by going to health clinics and by going to school. So families feel differently about these resources than they would feel about other kinds of transfers, to the extent that the mothers in particular feel that they've earned the right to these resources. So that implies that there's kind of a social controllership, so to speak, a social accountability associated with the way the program works, which makes corruption difficult. It doesn't mean impossible. It lowers the chance of corruption. But also, equally important, we structure the program in such a way that resources would flow directly from the federal government to the families without passing through any intermediaries, neither the state government nor municipal government nor any other official. The chain is very direct, and there are very little loopholes or spaces for corruption to occur.
You also don't allow the cash grants, as I understand, to be made right around the time of elections.
Not only that, what we do is, what was done since 97, was we deliver to mothers a little pamphlet which states that they have a right to the benefits of this program as long as they comply with the conditions of the program, that no official from any political party can request from them to vote in any particular direction, that nobody will take their vote, their program away if they vote in one way or the other, and nobody can request from them any sort of participation in any rally, meeting of any sort. And there's a big diffusion campaign to try to give people a sense of their rights and to minimize the chances of manipulation.
How did you manage to get this instituted in a country which has been famous for corruption, particularly at the local level in rural areas where there's nobody around to check on it, and it's difficult to find any accountability, and where the parties, particularly the PRI, which was still in charge when you began this program, has pretty much been based on that kind of thing?
I think the merit goes to President Zedillo. I mean, you can help with the technical design of a program, you can put forth the ideas, but at the end of the day, the person who's taking the political chances, the political risks, and the political cost of changing radically the way social policy was implemented was the president of Mexico at that time, President Zedillo. So I really give him a lot of merit. I mean, my contribution was, along with my team, because it was not only me, a lot of people in the finance ministry and other ministries, we worked together in this. I just had the privilege to be in charge of the program. But the real, you know, merit, in my sense, goes to President Zedillo. Once you have a backing from the president and you have a commitment from the president, if you have that kind of power, then you can go very, very far, because you have the backing to talk to governors, to talk to Mr. Presidents, and basically impose conditions.
And then President Zedillo's successors have carried it on.
Well, that was another important component of the program. As you were explaining and Tina was explaining in the beginning, this is a long-term investment. So it's no good if the program lasted only for 3 years or 5 years of a particular administration. So it was very important from the design, the initial design, to create conditions such that a new administration could feel comfortable with continuing with the program. And by not subjecting it to political manipulation, you could make it easy for a new administration to continue with something that they would not see as threatening their political base or their power base or their electoral prospects. And yes, indeed, President Fox, very responsibly in my view, I mean, he did change the name, but aside from the change of name, he continued with the program and he doubled the size.
Used to be called Progresa, now it's called Oportunidades.
Correct.
Excuse my Spanish pronunciation.
To give merit also to President Calderon, we're now into the second year of President, almost finishing the second year of President Calderon's mandate, and he has continued as well with the program. So this is actually important. It's now a program in which three different presidents from two political parties, President Zedillo from the PRI, and both President Fox and President Calderon from the National Action Party, the PAN Party, from three sexenios, three administrations, have continued now with the program. So this allows the sort of changing behavior that Tina was referring to. Households perceive this as permanent. They can now make long-term investments in their households, in their kids' education, in their health. And because they have the certainty that the support is going to be there, they can change their behavior in more productive ways, in more responsible ways.
Santiago Levy, who gets credit for beginning the program we're talking about now at the Inter-American Development Bank. Back to Tiesner Rosenberg with the New York Times Magazine. How is this measured and deemed successful by outsiders who are now, as you report, implementing similar kinds of programs in something like 30 countries?
Well, the banks, the international development banks like the Inter-American Development Bank, where Dr. Levy works, and the World Bank have taken this and have provided loans and technical advice for other countries to implement. And it is now being used in many parts of Latin America, and countries as far afield as South Africa and China have come to Mexico to take a look at it, to see whether it would be appropriate for their own circumstances. One of the things that the program does well is it has set up a lot of evaluation. And I think Dr. Levy knew from the beginning that he was going to have that. To be able to keep it going, he had to prove it was successful. So he built in a lot of evaluation. And a lot of people who study poverty, like Susan Parker, who's going to be on in a second, I guess, they've also studied a lot of different areas of the program. And the conclusions are that it's been really extraordinarily successful. The most basic measure is just Mexico's poverty statistics. In 1996, which was the year after the peso crash, 37.4% of Mexicans lived in extreme poverty, which means that they didn't have enough to eat. 10 years later, that number was down to 13.8%. So from 37.4 to 13.8. And that drop could not be just explained by economic growth, because Mexico's economic growth was not spectacular during that period. So that's really the most basic indication of how well it's working. One thing that's very interesting is we don't really know yet. We don't have good information about how it's affected the kids who grew up in it, the kids who are now in school because of Oportunidades and would not have been, what has happened to them as adults. It's been too early to see, but right now that is being studied, and there should be information out about that soon.
Okay, that gets to that issue of culture of poverty, which
right.
We talked about earlier, and we'll elaborate a bit on that as we go on. Dr. Levy, let me go back to you. Why is it that you decided, and very specifically and from a policy standpoint, to give the cash grants to women?
Because there's some literature, some empirical evidence of analysis before that it does matter for the spending pattern of a household, whether resources are channeled to women versus men. So on the basis of that, the idea was to give the resources for that person closely responsible to critical decisions within the household, decisions associated with the health of the household, the composition of the diet, and the attendance of kids to school. So it does matter whether the person who has additional income decides to buy for the kids milk or Coca-Cola. And by the mothers inducing them to go to these workshops where they would get information, aside from getting health checkups, they would also be provided precisely with this kind of information, because sometimes they don't know that it's really not good to give a kid a glass of Coca-Cola for breakfast, and it's much better to give him a glass of milk. And because we wanted to get this nutritional impact as an essential component to the program, we thought that unless mothers were involved critically in the program, that would not occur. And the way to get mothers involved was to empower them. And the way to empower them was to actually give them the cash directly to them so they make the spending decisions. In Tina's article, the one that came out on the magazine on Sunday, which is very nice, it talks initially about some conflict because there is a cultural change inside the household, because now, depending on the time of the year and the rural areas that you're talking about, women were bringing to the household, if not equivalent, similar amounts of money that men were making. And this changed the power relationship inside the household, in my view, to the better. There might have been some initial, you know, reaccommodation, but at the end of the day, the evidence shows that the additional income has translated into more diversified diets. People eat more cheese, more vegetables, more meat, and it has also translated into better clothing for kids. So now you don't see them barefoot. You see them with a little pair of tennis shoes when you go to these villages. And, you know, there's this nice quote, you know, they need a pencil so the mother can have money and buy the kid a pencil, and that makes a lot of difference. So that's why the recipient of the cash mattered, and making the mothers the centerpiece of the program, I think, has been an important component of its success.
Tina Rosenberg, back to you. Mexico is a nation famous for machismo. You went to Mexico, talked not just with women as involved in this program, but with men as well. Some of them, it sounds as if, had a little difficulty adjusting to this at the outset.
I think a lot of them did. One of my favorite characters in my story was a man named Pedro Hernandez, whose wife was a beneficiary of the program, and he hated it at first. He didn't want her to leave the house. And she'd go to her meetings, and he'd come barging in and say, "The dinner is burning. Come back and attend to it." And instead of turning the stove off himself, he would come pull her out. And he did this over and over again. "It's raining. The clothes are on the line. Come back and take them down." Of course, he couldn't be bothered to do that himself. And this was a constant source of conflict in the household and very difficult for her. And then something happened to him, which is that he had a burst appendix and needed to go to the hospital. And they went to the closest hospital, but it was a private hospital and was going to charge him an exorbitant sum of money for this family, $4,000 for the operation. But because Irma, his wife, is a member of Oportunidades, they got to get priority at a public hospital, and the operation cost him $100. So that changed Pedro Hernandez's world, and he started to think, gee, you know, maybe our family is getting something out of this. And now he really likes the program, and everybody I talked to in this village acknowledged that he's really changed. He really has changed. This wasn't just something to tell to a reporter. And he told me proudly that he now knows how to cook.
That is a real change. Tina Rosenberg again, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Dr. Santiago Levy is at the American Development Bank now. We're coming back with them and others as well, including Susan Parker, who was mentioned earlier by Tina Rosenberg. We'll talk also about the pilot program that is adopted from this going on in New York City. On Reporter's Notebook later, we're well, only back with To the Point. We're talking about Oportunidades, the anti-poverty program that has worldwide attention since it's been established in Mexico, was established in Mexico 10 years ago. We're talking with its founder, Santiago Levy, with Tina Rosenberg, who's written extensively about it in the New York Times Magazine. Susan Parker is a professor and a researcher at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics in Mexico City. And Susan Parker, it's very good to have you on our program.
Thank you very much, Warren. Please.
I know that you agree with much of what we've heard that's positive about this program, and I don't want to turn you into a naysayer, but we don't have a lot of time, and I'm interested in what you've discovered as an independent evaluator of Oportunidades, of what some of the issues are, some of the problems that have arisen.
Right. So I've worked on education evaluation, so the measure how many children. So you would expect in this program that children would go more to school, that children would spend more time in school because the money, of course, is linked to children being in school. So we've evaluated how much more schooling, education, do children achieve, do youth achieve. And we certainly found, sizable impact. So the biggest impact of the program has been to get children who normally would have dropped out after elementary or primary school to go on to junior high or secondary school, as it's called in Mexico. So that's a very positive change because that's really looking to the intergenerational transmission of poverty. So reducing, if these kids have more schooling, reducing the chance that they'll be poor in the future when they grow up, when they're adults. So turning to limitations, this has been a very, very, very positive aspect. Limitations are that, this program is not a cure-all for, all factors that affect future poverty, such as school quality. So the program is really focused on what we might call the demand area, so getting more kids into school, but it's not particularly focused on school quality and improving the quality of schools. So in rural areas, many schools are of poor quality. And so, one critic might say, why have children or youth spend more time in school if schools are not very good? And I, personally, my answer would be to that it's true that many schools need improving. But, I personally think that it's better for kids to be going to school, even if the schools are not very good, than to not be going to school at all, right? Because even if the schools are poor, they're still learning something. And whereas, they would just be home or working, and that's, in my opinion, less productive.
Or finding unproductive activities.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. So then your verdict on it is pretty much a positive. Obviously, it can't do everything. It can't improve the schools necessarily, just if it's an anti-poverty program.
Right. That's correct. And I think, one other interesting thing that has been happening is that, opportunities can only be received by communities that have access to schools within a certain geographical distance. And so actually it's been the case that some, very, very poor communities have been excluded, have not been able to participate because they don't have a school that's close enough so that, they can't be required to come, send the kids to school if there's no school that's close by. But these families, these communities are realizing now that they can't have the program because they don't have the school. And so that's leading also to kind of more, more community involvement saying, why don't we have a school? We need a school. And so that's also, something interesting.
With the kids going to school more, and regardless for the moment of the quality of the schools, has that changed their aspirations and what they think they might be able to achieve later in life?
Right. That's a very interesting topic that I think hasn't been studied enough. But, we have asked them, what level of school do you aspire to go on to? And you do have a higher percentage of kids saying they aspire to go on to high school, which is a pretty high level for these poor rural kids, high school and even college, which would really be something, to take a group of kids who normally would only have completed sixth grade and have them aspire to go to college. That's really important.
Okay, Susan Parker in Mexico City. Very quickly, back to Dr. Santiago Levy. I know you need to leave us, and I want to thank you in advance for taking the time to join us. What about the fact that even if the kids get out of school, go through high school, or get much further along than they have in the past, what are the prospects for them if there aren't any jobs available?
Well, that's a very important point, and that's kind of the next stage of where I think social policy and economic policy in Mexico need to address. Because Oportunidades is not a job creation program. It's a program that tries to improve the people's nutritional health and educational status and to create better prospects for the future. But unless the economy grows faster and unless the reasons why a lot of youngsters don't find good jobs are addressed, then it's going to be an extremely sad situation in which, as Susan pointed out, you might have a new generation of youngsters that have 4 or 5 years more education than the previous generation, and that's a qualitative jump. But nonetheless, at the end of the day, they're going to have with jobs that are not that much different from their parents. This is not a shortcoming of Oportunidades. This is a shortcoming of many other issues in Mexico that have unfortunately not been tackled. And the progress on those fronts is substantially less than in this program. In fact, arguably, Mexico is doing many other things that are working in the opposite direction of inducing people to create bad jobs. Tina mentions in her article towards the end that one sad thing about this program might just be that we improve the education and the health status of all these youngsters, and they end up working in San Antonio or in Miami or in Los Angeles or in Chicago. So all we did in the end is improve the labor force for the U.S. and not for Mexico. This is then a substantive problem and a major challenge towards the future. Oportunidades cannot solve this program. More things need to be done. We cannot expect an individual program to solve such a very, very complex issue.
Well, thank you again so very much for taking the time to be on our program today.
Well, let me thank again Tina for her article and wish you all a Happy New Year. Suzanne, Happy New Year to you too.
Thank you, Dr. Santiago Levy, again, Vice President for Sectors and Knowledge at the Inter-American Development Bank, formerly with the Mexican government and the establisher of the originator of the Oportunidades program. Susan Parker, back to you at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics in Mexico City. We've talked a lot about rural poverty, and that's where this program has been so successful. What about Mexico City and other urban areas in Mexico?
Right. So the program has been a few years in urban areas. It's not really in Mexico City yet. So the big metropolitan areas were kind of left for last for the program. It is in smaller metropolitan areas like Puebla. It's interesting. So the program is identical in those areas. So they have the same structure of benefits. Although urban context can be very different than rural, for instance, in terms of opportunity costs of children's time, and of course the quality of schools. So there is an evaluation of urban areas, and actually the impacts have been shown to be somewhat smaller than in rural areas. So that's a question, whether there needs to be some design changes in urban areas to make the program kind of more in accordance with its design. No, it was really designed for rural areas and extended to urban areas later.
Do you have ideas about what aspects of it might need to be changed in order to adapt it to urban situations?
Well, I think that you might need to increase the size of the grants because it's kind of the same money in urban areas is different from the same amount of money in rural areas, so that children have more competing uses of their time in urban areas. So I think that you might need to increase benefits in urban areas. You might need to, an interesting idea is to give some of these benefits to the youth, instead of to the mothers. I mean, certainly don't want to necessarily be giving an 8-year-old kid money, but to an 18-year-old, you might think of giving some of the benefits to that youth directly.
So the family culture, the family relationships are different in urban areas as well as the environment in so many ways.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Susan Parker, professor, researcher at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics in Mexico City. Let's turn to New York City. Jim Riccio directs the evaluation of the Opportunity NYC program for MDRC. That's a nonprofit social science research organization testing the effectiveness of new policies to alleviate poverty. Let's first talk about the new policies. Jim Riccio, good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
Mayor Bloomberg took a very strong interest in this program in Mexico and decided to try it out in some form in New York City. You're evaluating it. Tell us, first of all, how it came to be.
Well, the mayor had commissioned a group of experts in New York City to advise him on new strategies for reducing poverty in the city. And some members of that committee were familiar with the Mexican program and took some inspiration from it. And so one thing led to another, and the city had decided to see if they could put together a version of Oportunidades that would be adapted and suitable for New York City and subjected to a significant and serious evaluation to determine whether, in fact, it could help reduce poverty.
One major difference, private money is involved in this one.
Yes, it is.
Okay. Tell us which neighborhoods it's being used in and how it's working out.
Okay, it's being tested in six very high poverty neighborhoods in New York City, two in Manhattan, two in Brooklyn, and two in the Bronx. And the way it's structured is that there are community groups in each of those have enrolled families who have very low incomes, and those families were randomly allocated to a program or a control group, and the group that is in the program is given essentially an offer of a set of incentives or rewards. Each of these rewards is tied to some kind of effort and accomplishment that can contribute to the reduction of poverty in the longer term, as well as be a way of getting more money in the short term to reduce their immediate hardship. So, for example, as in Mexico, rewards were attached to children's educational efforts and performance, families' efforts to get preventive medical care and dental care, and unlike Mexico, parents' efforts to work full-time and to take on training courses while they were working in order to improve their own skills. So in an important respect, it was a way to help reduce immediate hardship. At the same time, you are encouraging and supporting families to invest in their own futures.
So this goes well beyond what we refer to as welfare reform, because people get compensated for what they do for themselves, not just they're not just being put to work.
Correct.
How's it worked?
Well, it's underway now. As I mentioned, we have a very serious evaluation in progress. We don't have any of the results yet that would tell us whether it's made a difference in terms of reducing poverty or increasing school or health or other or work outcomes or other outcomes. That's still to come. The program's too new. But it has been successful so far in engaging the families very substantially. So most of the families have so far earned and received a payment of one kind or another. Many families have received payments in each period since the program has begun. So far, substantial amounts of money have been transferred. On average, families have received close to about $3,000 extra dollars. And that money does not affect, if they're on welfare, does not affect their current welfare grant or food stamps or other kinds of transfer payments. So many families have extra resources now. We have only anecdotal evidence that suggests that some families are seeing improvements in their children's school performance. And are making extra efforts to get preventive medical care and so forth and to look for work. But we really won't have conclusive evidence of that until we have all the data in that we need to make that assessment.
Are you focusing on women as they do in Mexico?
Not exclusively, but about 80% of the group in the program is made up of single parents, and most of those are indeed women.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Jim Riccio again, directing the evaluation of Opportunity NYC. Tina Rosenberg, back to you with the New York Times Magazine. You point out that this program wherever it's being implemented sort of transcends, or in this country at least, transcends a philosophical dispute about poverty and the causes of poverty. Tell us a bit about that.
That's right, Warren. One of the things that intrigued me when I started to look at this is that a lot of people said, oh, but the causes of poverty in rural Mexico are so different than the causes of poverty in New York City, which is undoubtedly correct. However, the thing that I find most interesting about the program's transplantation to New York City is it may not matter what the causes of poverty are. One of the things that both groups, poor in Mexico and poor in New York, have in common is we respond to money. We respond to payments. And the debate in the United States is, why is it that poor people are poor? For example, the classic debate about the culture of poverty. The teacher complains, I cannot get the parent to come to the parent-teacher meetings. The parents don't seem all that interested in their kids' education. Some people would say, well, this is an overstressed single mom who's trying to hold down two jobs, and she just doesn't have time to get there. This is a person who would be helped by Opportunity NYC because she will get a payment, and she will also get enough extra money to get them a Metro card so she can make the trip, and she'll find it worth it to take 2 hours off work to go to the parent-teacher conference because she will be getting paid for it. But then the other kind of parent, the one who doesn't come to the parent-teacher conference because they just don't care, it might help her also because now she might care because she's going to get paid. I mean, that's the thing that I find very interesting. It sort of skips over that whole debate between the right and the left about what is the cause of this culture of poverty. It can be the solution. We don't know. We have to evaluate it. But it can be the solution no matter what the cause of the problem is.
Jim Riccio, in New York City, do you find that there are people who simply don't respond, even if they are offered money and just simply don't show any interest?
There have been some, although I'd say it's clearly a minority in the program so far. So, as I mentioned, probably 91% of those who are in the program have already received a payment for meeting some of the conditions that have already been established. There will undoubtedly be people who won't respond, and we'll try to learn why they don't respond. But it may partly be because their lives are very complicated, and this is a small thing that they can't focus on, given other problems that they're contending with. Some may have already moved out of the city, but it'll be something that's very important for the research to try to understand.
Tina Rosenberg, are there people who argue that there's a trap here, that you're liable to set up a situation where people won't do things even if they work to their own advantage if they don't get paid?
Well, that's the argument of some of the conservative commentators, which is it's morally wrong to be paying people to do something that they should be doing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get into a situation where people are going to say, oh, no, I'm only going to do it if you keep those payments coming. I don't know. That's obviously something you're going to have to test at some point later on if this program gets expanded. But it seems to me from the people I met is that the program does change you. The act of going to your child's parent-teacher conference changes you. You want to go a second time. You want to go a third time. You get more involved in your kid's education, and you don't go back to being the person you were before. So I suspect that phenomenon does occur, it will be small. One of the sites I visited in New York did have families that had not yet picked up their coupon books, which meant that they had been... The organization had tried to notify them, and they just didn't come to get their coupon books to get started. But most of those families had been unreached because they had moved or something like that. So I think it's a very small percentage of families who actually are not getting started in the program just because they're not interested.
All right. If, in fact, this does change people, obviously, that is the goal, one would think fundamentally, to eliminate the culture of poverty. Then, of course, the question is, will there be jobs available and places for them to go once they decide they want to? Thank you all very much for being with us. Again, Tina Rosenberg is contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. Jim Riccio is doing evaluation of Opportunity NYC in New York. Susan Parker, professor, researcher at the Center for Research and Teaching in Economics in Mexico City, and our earlier guest, Santiago Levy, with the Inter-American Development Bank, the creator of the Oportunidades program in Mexico.